Today we will explore the most devastating veterans within the arsenal of the Imperium, the horrifying machines of war, dreadnoughts. But while they are the Imperium's masters of war, they stand against entities of the Xenos and the Heretic, which is soon to be explored in Tacticus. Starting June 10th, Tacticus will begin a new series of Machines of War events. This will introduce a new 6th unit for players to deploy, and features the likes of Field Ordnance of the Militarum, Demon Engines such as the Forge Fiend of Chaos, and Xenos Horrors like the Tyranid Biovore. Additional new units will join the lineup in the future. In Tacticus, these new Machines of War will have an active primary ability for you to use, plus a secondary which may be passive. These will enable a mixture of direct or strategic engagement against your enemy. This new addition to the game will be present in the Arena, Tournament Arena, Guild Raids and Guild Wars modes. And whilst they cannot be directly attacked or destroyed, they contribute a supporting role to add tactical complexity to how you engage with your enemy across the detailed Hex battlefields. Warhammer 40,000 Tacticus continues to add many new champions and factions, plus events like Machines of War. Its free-to-play model offers a rewarding gameplay cycle of progression, achievement, and customization in your forces, each with their own specific traits and strategies. Within this format of game, there remains an element of grind, as I've discussed before, but the devs have worked hard to balance this to make it as engaging as possible within the archetype. There are of course also the PvE campaigns where you will secure components to ensure your squad strength, a critical factor in overcoming these missions, and these can also be played as a mirror where you take on the role of the enemy. Alternately, you can fight quick turn-based battles in the PvE section and join collaborative boss fights under your guild banner. Tacticus is the definitive tactical mobile game for Warhammer 40,000, and if you've never tried it before, I encourage you to take command and unleash the new devastating Machines of War. Use the QR code on screen now, click the links below, and use my code below, Lutin0524, for additional benefits when you join Tacticus today. By any human standards, Astartes are functionally immortal. The adaptations they undergo to become the ultimate warriors of the galaxy ensure that they can live for many centuries, even millennia. Yet they also understand that this privilege comes at a cost, that of the human experience. For an Astartes will not experience all the markers of life that define and unite us: aging, frailty, family, and eventually death. They know that when their end eventually comes, it will be not with loved ones around them to mark the passing into whatever lies beyond. Their end will be one of violence. Because, of course, for Space Marines, only in death does duty end. They will live until they are liquidated by horrifying Xenos, carved and broken by heretics, or consumed by the Void. Yet this fact is also something that strengthens and unifies the Astartes. It is a certainty that they all understand, and it strengthens the bonds of brotherhood between them. They all understand and accept the sacrifices they have made. Most will have no memory of their families or anyone they ever knew, their name will have been changed, and they now exist only to serve the God Emperor of mankind. Yet for some, what would otherwise be a certain death when this time comes, it is in fact not the end. Astartes who reached the end usually are already respected and revered among their brothers, and so they may be granted one of the most prestigious honours bestowed upon a rare few, to continue service to the Emperor of Man, and be placed within a specially crafted amniotic armoured casket, a living embodiment of all that the Machine God represents, the endurance of knowledge through the fusion of man and machine. These rare few will be entombed and so serve their chapter as a devastatingly powerful machine of war upon the harrowing warscapes of the grim dark future. They shall become war incarnate. They will become a dreadnought. But in truth, it is a fate that all would accept, but for many, it may not be the end they would wish for. To an ordinary human civilian in the Imperium, dreadnoughts could easily and may often be mistaken for robotic war machines, This, of course, does not mean actual AI, as would be impossible given the Imperium's moratorium on AI, but remember, of course, the Mechanicus do have robotic war machines. But the reality of just how a dreadnought functions is appropriate for the bleak, soul-crushing darkness that exists as life in one of the most authoritarian and uncaring empires ever brought into existence by humanity. It would be too much to say that becoming a dreadnought is close to servitorization, but it's not a million miles away. Little, if anything, though, is known regarding the origins of dreadnoughts, although it's fairly reasonable to presume that these war machines emerged out of originally a necessity during the unification period on Terra, one which saw intense warfare and where the Emperor was utilizing a considerably smaller army, which consisted largely of what were known as the Thunder Warriors, these themselves proto-Astartes. But one much earlier and very likely source, as are so many things, the technology for dreadnoughts came out of the Dark Age of Technology. What purpose it may have had at that time, unknown, but very often these were sort of industrial purposes. It's even said that earlier iterations of dreadnoughts were able to be controlled by ordinary humans around the turn of the Age of Strife and the Unification Wars, which of course would be revisited by the Primaris in the contemporary Imperium. But once the Emperor's Great Crusade began, the focus was entirely upon supplying whatever was required by the Astartes, an ever-repeating cycle of upgrading hardware for the new elite warriors of humanity who benefited from the Black Carapace, this neural interface which sees connection plugs across an Astartes connected throughout their body and thus enabling them to enmesh fully with whatever powered armor they are wearing. And this allows them to move as if they were simply wearing a carapace armor. It's one of the greatest differences between Astartes and all other Imperial forces. Even the Sisters of the Sororitas do not feature these interface plugs throughout the body, and it's why their power armor is custom designed to be less weighty and enable greater freedom of movement, so that they can at least have the speed and maneuverability of, say, an Astartes. But this comes at the expense of their survivability. This is also the case in others who wear powered armor, such as Inquisitors. They're often custom designed suits. They're not directly Space Marine power armor suits. They wouldn't fit, for one thing. But of course, it should always be remembered that any human can technically use powered armor. It just is difficult and greatly limiting for those who are not trained or augmented, as seen in the more elite forces of the Imperium. With all of this in mind, there were of course the much more ancient proto-dreadnoughts of eras past. And these were very much more likely akin to some variant of an exosuit. And these may well be evidenced by the fact that the Votan, otherwise known as Squats, have available to them so-called Vartian Exodrillers. It's effectively a mining suit, but given the fact that the Votan are essentially a tangent offshoot of humanity in the aftermath of the Dark Age of Technology, it is hard to ignore that these things really, really look like a dreadnought. Still, on the other hand, most factions within the galaxy of M41 have some form of bipedal encased walker. Still, it is a natural conclusion to make. Of course, whatever the true answer to how dreadnoughts came into being, this will lie within the archives of the Mechanicus. And as is often the case, the specific details regarding the construction of many variants of Dreadnought, especially the earliest forms, have been lost. And it's only the secrets and arcane knowledge used by the Mechanicus which enables those earliest variants to survive at all and function in M41. Ultimately, and obviously, Dreadnoughts were conceptualized as a way to preserve and maintain some of the greatest Astartes warriors who had fallen in battle, but remained alive by a thread. By permanently entombing them within a dreadnought sarcophagus, this provided the remains of the Battle Brother with a highly advanced life support system that would preserve them when no other solution were available. These sarcophagi are then placed within the exoframe of these immense bipedal war machines, and which are by default armed with multiple heavy weapon and defensive systems. And this is one of the core advantages seen in dreadnoughts. It's their ability to be armed for almost any battlefield role, but also maintain significant endurance in the face of terrifyingly powerful enemies. So if a powerful veteran space marine is mortally wounded on the battlefield, crippled by some extreme blow or devastating impact that literally breaks their body and smashes them to pieces, if still alive and neurally intact, instead of being mercifully killed by a brother Astartes, they could be kept alive, and if possible, entombed within the sarcophagus of a dreadnought. Their brain will be linked straight into the cybernetic components and mechanisms of the Dreadnought, and from there on able to use the war machine as if it were their own body. Their broken remains are housed within these thick ceramite shells so as to protect them from the very harsh battle environments. But outwardly, they are near indestructible. The Astartes within, though, a pitiful shadow of their former selves. Their ruined remains are kept alive only so that the neural part of the marine functions and will forevermore use their mechanically enhanced senses to perceive the world around him. This is not a space marine death, it is a glorious rebirth, or at least in the eyes of the Mechanicus. But this process enabled not only the greatest warriors of the Emperor to continue on fighting beyond what would have otherwise been their death, but it also allows Space Marine chapters and the Imperium to benefit from the extensive wisdom preserved in these legends of Imperial history. One might imagine that given their inherent survivability, being encased in some of the most dense armour available to Astartes, Dreadnoughts would be a common sight on the battlefields of M41 or any battle from the Heresy onward. Except, this is not necessarily the case, because, like most chapter relics, they are venerated and incredibly difficult to maintain and support. Dreadnoughts, whilst appearing little more than personal walkers with extremely heavy armour, are in fact more difficult to maintain than you might imagine, and this is largely because of the advanced systems that preserve the Astartes within, not to mention the fact that they are quite large machines and therefore have a quite powerful machine spirit. Thus, most Dreadnoughts are held securely within a chapter's fortress monastery, or whatever their equivalent, say for a fleet-borne force. In this chapter monastery, Dreadnoughts are also generally kept in stasis, that is to stay in suspended animation, frozen in time, as was Rabuti Gilliman before his resurrection. In part, this is to preserve the sanity of the Space Marine entombed, because to exist as a Dreadnought is not a comfortable nor pleasant experience. In fact, for many Astartes, it is an unbearably horrific existence. To not be able to breathe, to move, to speak with others, they are to all intents and purposes little more than a brain in a jar, and for the ultimate warriors of humanity, this is a nightmare scenario. Yet these veterans will endure, because they serve the Emperor, and only in death does duty end. Most Dreadnoughts will only be woken from their sleep, though, when a severe threat faces the Imperium or some other critical mission develops. For that Astartes within, their new existence presents a disturbing new reality, which sees them only experiencing periodic snapshots of reality. And this is due to the fact that they may be awoken for anything as long as even 1,000 years since their previous engagement. Consequently, things may well have changed significantly, including their own chapter, if it even still exists. Many battle brothers they once knew will have passed, and new and unknown faces will now be present. Conversely, it can be very strange and enlightening for the new Astartes or even Primaris to find themselves able to converse with a uniquely ancient marine. In the rarest of scenarios, it could even be an individual who perhaps walked alongside or witnessed the Emperor in those earliest days of the Imperium and the Crusade, or at least one who witnessed other legendary moments in Imperial history, such as the scouring of traitors, the dissolving of the legions. When it comes to communication, Dreadnoughts are equipped with a speaker system to enable them to communicate with brother marines on the ground, but their voices are obviously not their own, and so instead what emanates from the Dreadnought is a wholly machine voice, making interaction with Dreadnoughts for some quite an unsettling experience. But no matter how they were originally developed, the platform would evolve into becoming a means by which for the Astartes to maximise the balance of survival and their lethality. Although similarly to Terminator armour, further developments of what could have been a superlative piece of equipment for the Imperium did suffer as a consequence of the Heresy. Indeed, when it comes to Dreadnoughts, it's important to remember the differences between a pattern and a variant. A pattern is the specific model of Dreadnought, and these can vary wildly in terms of their age. They have pros and cons to their overall power, but most are significantly different visually. Pattern is effectively the same as with anything else in the Imperium. Different constructs of Lehman Russ, they are different patterns. Different types of plasma guns are often noted as being, say, Riser or Mars pattern. And what that is denoting is the Mechanicus Forge world to which that hardware was produced, because although the Imperium operates under and using this STC system, which should theoretically standardise all equipment throughout the Imperium, some worlds will still produce more effective variants that are somehow slightly more efficient, slightly more powerful. And that can sometimes mean that these are the only variation accepted within certain regiments of the Militarum, for example, will defer to using a type of lasgun. Whereas a variant of Dreadnought tends to refer primarily to their weapon loadout, although it can also speak to other specialised details. But the only reason variants are noted at all is usually due to the fact that Astartes ensure their dreadnoughts are most effective in the situations they're deployed to, but also some chapters of Astartes may, for example, maintain specific variants of dreadnought because they better suit the role required in supporting that chapter's broader tactical preferences and approach to engagements like White Scars and so on. But there are more specific niche examples as well, such as Librarian Dreadnoughts, which obviously are optimised for their Psyker Astartes entombed within, and then Chaplain Dreadnoughts, which are pretty self-explanatory. They contain venerated chaplains of a Space Marine chapter. And that is one of the most interesting things about a Dreadnought. Yes, they are these devastating war machines, but they can also become chapter relics. They are these venerated constructs which contain an ancient marine, which gives a lot of the other Astartes something to gather around and be inspired by. Because a dreadnought is a distillation of human and transhuman willpower. It is to fight back in the face of death, to choose to serve the Emperor anew as a living heavy tank, a cybernetically enhanced killing machine of earth-shaking power and strength. If you were an Astartes, who wouldn't be inspired by that? But it would not be particularly common to see a dreadnought deployed as a frontline role, as a vanguard unit. They tend to be more of a heavy support platform for infantry. And throughout the Age of the Imperium, one of the most commonly deployed patterns is the Castrofarum Mark IV and V. These were chosen because of their enduring, adaptable thermic reactor, which is more serviceable and more well understood than many of the older pattern dreadnoughts. And that is again why many examples of equipment from the Age of the Crusade and the Heresy have just ceased to be seen in M41. They may have survived, but the Mechanicus simply does not have the knowledge or the individuals capable of servicing such refined constructs, and so they defer to the other more standardised practical examples that are available. In terms of the stasis vault or the crypt within an Astartes fortress monastery which houses their dreadnoughts, this is more than just a place to store them until needed. Like I said, it is a holy shrine. Astartes tech marines will tend to the dreadnoughts with the utmost care and diligence, as is tradition for the style of the Imperium. Also, be sure to apply many sacred oils and chants to preserve their sacred spirits, all of which will culminate in undoubtedly applying a pretty liberal use of incense as well, just to be safe. And all of this is carried out in service of honouring the broken but revered heroes who embody everything their chapter is and who remain ready at any time to serve their brother Astartes and the Emperor. For once interred within the sarcophagus of a dreadnought, there is no turning back, no alternative, no end. This extended existence is for many a form of imprisoned service to the Emperor, although few would dare to admit that. And while it enables them to continue on well past their mortal lives, few Astartes would actively choose such a fate. And this may be why dreadnoughts are not unknown to throw themselves with little, if any, fear into battle against truly horrifying enemies. And whilst this may bring devastating layers of destruction upon the enemies of humanity, one may wonder how dissimilar these are to the penitent engines used by the Ecclesiarchy and the Sororitas, where those who are placed within such engines will commonly throw themselves into battle so aggressively. This is only partly out of a sense to destroy their enemy, but it is certainly as much to attempt to end their own suffering. How true such actions might be for one placed within a dreadnought is likely a very sliding scale dependent on the Astartes within. But it is certain that a dreadnought will otherwise lead a life of endless battles until they are eventually destroyed. To their brothers, of course, the dreadnought represents a total embodiment of all that the Astartes strive for in their lives, unending loyalty, total commitment to the tenets and ideals of what it means to be an Astartes, to never give up or step back, fighting for the Imperium and the Emperor, no matter the injury or the obstacle, to never give any sign or thought of weakness until they are finally and completely dead. Considering just the machine itself, though, dreadnoughts, like most things employed by the Imperium, are immensely powerful in both their defensive and attack capabilities. Their armoured shells are constructed from a combination of thick ceramite and adamantium, ceramite being a very non-conductive and, yes, ceramic mesh that is very effective at protecting versus heat and energy-based weapons, and that is then enmeshed with adamantium, one of the strongest materials used by the Imperium of Man, and this is the same material used in the construction of the Emperor's Eternity Gate, the final entrance that protects the Emperor, who sits upon his golden throne within the Imperial Palace on Terra. The limbs of a dreadnought are similarly armoured and all connected via durable, well-protected bundles of electrofibres and magna coils. Astartes Tech Marines will equip the dreadnought with whatever weapons and tools necessary to suit the mission they're assigned to, and these are all fairly typical for the Astartes, but one feature seen in dreadnoughts are that the heavy weapons they use are often the twin-linked variants, as you might see on Imperial tanks, like twin las cannons, twin autocannons, twin heavy bolters. Those singular weapons they carry tend to be of the more specialist variants, such as multi-melter, plasma, and assault cannons. The left arm of a dreadnought tends to be melee focused, and so it's often seen with a power claw or a fist, which then is often additionally combined with, say, a storm bolter or a heavy flamer. The entire left arm can also sometimes be replaced with a missile launcher unit when this level of firepower is required for longer range engagements. The right arm of the dreadnought can also be replaced with an additional melee system should the situation warrant, and this presents a dreadnought as a truly terrifying enemy for close quarter battles. The main carapace itself can also be equipped with additional armour plating to protect weaker points if there is the expectation that a given engagement is going to be especially heavy. Some more powerful dreadnoughts may also have carapace-mounted weapon systems, usually flame or bolters, but in the more ancient machines of war, sometimes Volkite systems. Then atop most dreadnoughts will be a mounted smoke launcher system. These are a non-lethal self-defense system to create a localized smoke barrier in and around the dreadnought, and this can be used tactically as necessary, or if a unit is found in a situation with little or no available cover, it could also be used to protect other units who need to embark or disembark battlefield dropships, etc. In the more contemporary dreadnoughts, though, such as the Redemptor, these mounted systems are more combat-focused, either seeing an Icarus rocket pod for defence against air units, or in the case of the Melee Brutalis dreadnoughts, twin Icarus Iron Hell heavy stubbers, thus enabling some ranged focus. But for all of this, and as powerful as a dreadnought is, it can still be critically disabled. This, though, is simply the machine element. So long as the armoured sarcophagus tomb containing the pilot is intact, then it can be recovered and hopefully repaired. Which may comically result in the Astartes waking to discover that they did not in fact die in battle, but they're still here, still entombed, still facing centuries of service to the Emperor. Of course, if a dreadnought is ever critically disabled, destroyed or broken in battle, then as with many powerful relics of the Imperium like Titans and Knights, Space Marines will fight with bitter and fanatical fury to recover not just the machine itself but mainly its occupant. The veteran Marine will then finally be returned to the chapter's mausoleum for his deserved, likely long overdue resting place, where the eternal glory of all mankind awaits. Proto-dreadnoughts are perhaps not surprisingly beyond rare. Few, if any, examples are known to exist, and any that do are likely sealed away for all time beneath the Imperial Palace or within the vaults of Mars. For they were considerably rudimentary by the comparative later standards of the Imperium, especially as Astartes entered the era of Primaris. Proto-dreadnoughts is not actually a specific pattern of dreadnought, though. It's more of a catch-all term for pre-Imperium dreadnoughts or just ancient dreadnoughts, which could date back through to the Dark Age of Technology or up until the end of the Heresy. It's easy to understand why in this time dreadnoughts would have been conceived, especially if you say in the ancient times on a colony world were a critical member and suffered a life-threatening injury that simply for whatever reason you could not be healed. It's very plausible that an STC would come up with some solution to preserve that person's life, and indeed during the Crusade they found worlds where there were members of colonies who were being held in effectually perpetual stasis, suspended animation, in this way. And this kind of thing could very well be the origin of dreadnoughts, or that they were originally some sort of labour-saving machine to assist colonists carry out tasks, in the same way that land raiders were effectively believed to be tractors originally. They also could be some adaptation of an AI system. It's possible in the ancient past of humanity they were even some sort of precursor to the knights and titan forms that would emerge later. I've often considered that proto-dreadnoughts might have emerged out of a need to increase survivability and also to fight back against the problems that arose around AI during the war with the Men of Iron. And given the very basic forms that dreadnoughts present, this to me seems logically plausible. Ultimately, though, of course, who can say, as we are unlikely to ever know. Early proto-dreadnoughts, as noted earlier, are said to have been capable of being also piloted by unenhanced humans, which supports those ideas. And those earlier models were very bulky, less agile, often more mechanically simple, but they provided the necessary brute strength and battlefield presence to do what they needed. Because of their power, heavy construction, and general survivability, it's understood that many of these proto-dreadnoughts did survive through the Age of Strife and into the Unification Wars to then be reappropriated as they were brought together under the banner of the Emperor. And these proto-dreadnoughts served multiple roles during that time. They could break enemy lines, provide heavy fire support, and endured substantial punishment against techno-barbarians, warlords, and the like that would incapacitate standard troops or lighter vehicles. Their presence bolstered morale and provided a tangible visual symbol of the Emperor's might that was even more terrifying than the monstrous Thunder Warriors who butchered many human settlements upon the wastelands of Terra. These would become the prototype foundational platform to later combine the superhuman advancements of the new Astartes and enable an advanced war machine to emerge out of this time for the Imperium. Dreadnoughts, though, continued to evolve through improvements and technological rediscoveries, leading to the more sophisticated and revered dreadnoughts of the 41st millennium. And this involved enhancements in armor plating, weapon systems, the integration of broadly more advanced technology and materials as they were available, as is the case with all technology in the Imperium. Dreadnoughts were originally a combination of power and visual symbolism for the Emperor's new empire. But as humanity emerged out of the Heresy era, they became necessary due to the dire need for resilient, powerful units during this tumultuous period of the Imperium's expansion. They embodied the fusion of human ingenuity and the relentless spirit of the Space Marines, setting the stage for the formidable war machines which would follow and are now cemented as a permanent element of Space Marine hardware. The Furibundus Dreadnought is a rarely seen relic from the earliest days of the Imperium, and perhaps even prior to its creation, yet it still represented a formidable class of dreadnought despite it predating mass-produced patterns that you would see in later eras. It's most well known for its distinct aesthetic design, which features a bulkier and more rounded carapace compared to its successors. Its design incorporates a mix of ancient technology and robust materials, making it a durable and resilient war machine. The central body is heavily armoured with thick ceramite plating, providing substantial protection. And strangely, compared to other iterations, the Dreadnought's torso is somewhat cylindrical, with pronounced shoulder mounts that house the primary weaponry. Then the head of the Furibundus Dreadnought is distinctly domed, which is connected to the main body by a reinforced neck joint, and this is said to allow for a wider range of motion and improved battlefield awareness. The legs, shorter and sturdier, designed to support the massive weight of the dreadnought and provide stability. But the Furibundus was equipped with a pretty basic set of weaponry compared to later dreadnoughts. It featured twin-linked autocannons, which again is a fairly basic weapon, fully automatic, standard munitions, mostly used by the Militarum, not at all like the advanced bolt weapons of Marines. But the twin-linked version was capable of delivering a considerable stream of fire that would shred infantry and tear apart light vehicles. The sustained fire would often overload and also collapse some personal and vehicle energy shielding. Then mounted on the Dreadnought's other arm, a heavy flamer, and this allowed the Furibundus to engage enemy infantry in cover or entrenched positions, deploying a liquid torrent of promethium-fueled fire, and this meant that despite its bulk, as is the case with all Dreadnoughts, it still enables them to clear out bunker positions, trenches, other fortifications. Now, some variants of the Furibundus chose to replace this heavy flamer with a fairly standard, for the time, power fist, enabling it to engage in close combat situations. And just for the sake of saying it, there are other benefits as well, because a power fist can crush, it can rip into tanks, which you might then finish off by filling with promethium or infantry units to throw grenades or whatever else they're carrying. It can also tear through reinforced armor, blast doors, and obviously destroy enemy troops in melee combat. But despite being an early dreadnought, its basic construction and heavy armor allowed it to withstand pretty significant punishment, making it a reliable frontline unit. The combination of ranged and close combat weaponry gave it some flexibility, and its more uniquely styled head position granted the Dreadnought decent accuracy and situational awareness, and this was then bolstered by basic sensor systems to detect hidden enemies, guide its weapons, enhance the pilot's ability to make tactical decisions in the heat of battle. And although many might look upon the Furibundus Dreadnought as now a fairly clunky, obsolete unit, it holds a significant place in the history of the Astartes. Its design reflects the technological experimentation and diversity that characterised the early days of the Imperium, and as a relic of the Great Crusade and the Horus Heresy, the Furibundus is highly valued by any chapters that still possess one. Not to mention the fact that if they were ever actually deployed now, the enemy might not know what they were dealing with. And even though it is very likely to be overshadowed by more modern Dreadnought patterns, it remains a revered and respected war machine from the time of their inception through to the age of eternal crusades against the innumerable enemies of the Imperium. We then have the still rare Contemptor and Dorito Dreadnoughts. Both of these are examples of advanced Dreadnoughts originating from around the time of the Crusade and into the Heresy. This is where we enter the strange period where older examples of Imperial technology were in fact more powerful and functionally advanced compared to their more contemporary Castafarum dreadnoughts seen in M41. And this is often the case with all manner of Imperial technology, where ships, for example, from the age of the Crusade and the Heresy are now not only unable to be produced by the Imperium, but are in fact more powerful than what they're able to construct. Which is a very bizarre technological juxtaposition, where the more ancient is in fact the more advanced. Then also, due to their rarity, they are extremely prized by any chapters who still hold and maintain them. It's widely understood that both these patterns of Dreadnought are no longer capable of being constructed due to their advanced tech within their systems. One example is the energy shielding for the Dorito. This utilizes what is known as an Atomantic Pervase energy shield, something that is just never seen upon any other Imperial vehicle now. The Contemptor also uses an Atomantic Field Generator, and these are almost mythical pieces of technology which are now barely, if at all, understood, and generates a protective gravitic shield around the walker using its Atomantic Power Core. These provide greater protection from both ranged and melee attacks, however, if they are damaged, an Atomantic Power Generator can overload and result in a devastating miniature atomic explosion which can badly damage any within its vicinity. The Contemptor was designed as the more evolved standard battle line dreadnought that could be outfitted with an arsenal of weaponry, whereas the Dorito fulfilled the specific role of heavy weapons support fire. The two patterns share much in common, but each was optimized for their specific battlefield role. The Contemptor being more mobile and wielding close quarter weaponry, the Dorito focused on stability and holding a power plant capable of driving devastating weapons like the Volkite and its terrifying plasma cannonade. It also was able to be mounted with several options of long-range missile ordnance. Standing considerably larger and more powerful than many of its successors, the Contemptor pattern Dreadnought was a key component of the early Space Marine legions raised on Terra during the 31st millennium. Its design and superior technology made it a cornerstone of the Imperium's initial expansion efforts. It is easily identified compared to modern equivalents due to its distinct rounded armoured carapace, and it began to approach something more akin to an exosuit than the stompy walkers that would become the default in M41. Indeed, the Contemptor and to a degree the Dorito felt as more of an effort to represent the Astartes who had served in life beyond them simply being encased in an amorphous war machine. Something that would only be later seen in, say, venerable dreadnoughts and those of the Custodes. Evidence of the Contemptor's ancient origins can also be found scattered all throughout the Imperium. They're seen in relics, monuments on hive worlds like Necromunda and Lorin Alpha, where these mighty war machines once strode as part of the earliest Astartes forces. The sight of such relics maintains the Dreadnoughts and the Astartes' enduring presence. It speaks to the role that these machines of war played, and it goes beyond simply the literal and into that of the cultural history, the collective memory that Astartes' Contemptors played during the formative years of the Imperium. The technology of the Contemptor and Dorito Dreadnoughts were representative of the developments that were taking place during the Crusade, where the Mechanicum and Imperial forces were steadily amassing huge new quantities of technology. As they discovered lost colonies and forge worlds, this meant the Mechanicum, of course, continued to improve to build into their own machines of war advanced systems. These were seen in the robot constructs of the Legio Cybernetica, and this would then be duplicated over into Astartes dreadnoughts, such as the Atomantic Field Generators. The increased survivability and new technology for these armor platforms enabled both heavier armament and improved flexibility. As such, standard armament for the Contemptor included a twin-linked heavy bolter and a dreadnought close quarter weapon with built-in storm bolter, but it could be very easily modified beyond such basic tactical needs with what are now seen as fairly standard options but were quite significant for the time in terms of flexibility, and thus included multi-melter, twin-linked heavy flamer, twin-linked autocannon, plasma cannon, assault cannon, twin las cannon, and something rarely seen now, a heavy conversion beamer. For melee, they also had the option of a chain fist with a built-in storm bolter again. And they also could carry additional weaponry like compact plasma blasters, graviton guns, carapace-mounted cyclone missile launchers, all of which further expanded its versatility. Overall, Contemptor dreadnoughts were considerably more adaptable and powerful than some of their contemporary equivalents. They had an array of defensive additions like extra ceramite plating, searchlights, advanced targeting systems that could all be added to enhance its overall effectiveness. And during the height of the Great Crusade, the Contemptor served alongside other dreadnought patterns, but unlike contemporary equivalents, they would spearhead assaults for the legions. And as the heresy descended, of course, what this would mean is that dreadnoughts were often thrown into the worst of the fighting, and this meant they suffered heavy losses. So, in the aftermath of the heresy, the chaotic period of scouring, and the general collapse and massive loss of so much knowledge that had been the Mechanicum, this meant that the knowledge required to manufacture and maintain these type of dreadnoughts was all but lost. In fact, in M41, Contemptor dreadnoughts and Dorito are so rare that when they do take to the battlefield, they are a living reminder of the Imperium's golden age. They would be something which inspires both awe and terrifying fear. Though few in number, they exist as some of the most pointed examples of the kind of war machines which could have, and may still exist, in the contemporary Imperium. For those who have endured through to the Era Indomitus, they continue to serve as beacons of the Emperor's might, reminding all who witness them of the Imperium's glorious past and its relentless, unbreakable determination to persevere against the darkness that threatens to descend upon the entire galaxy. And then we come to the Leviathans. For me personally, Leviathans are simply the ultimate dreadnought, and they really were the pinnacle of Imperial technology in the time of the Crusade and Heresy. But Leviathans were created in extremely low numbers. They were especially unusual compared to other dreadnoughts, as they were designed and created not on the home planet of the Mechanicus, Mars, which was of course then the Mechanicum, or even one of its forge worlds. No, it was very strange that Leviathan dreadnoughts were constructed upon Terra itself. From the perspective of the Mechanicum, the development of such a piece of technology outside the realm of their control was unsurprisingly not received well. In fact, they believed that the Leviathan dreadnoughts were being designed specifically with the potential to overpower their Cybernetica wetware robots at some future juncture, which, when given the Emperor's penchant for maintaining absolute control over his plans at any cost, this seems like a conflict that very well could have happened along the way were it not for the heresy. The Leviathan dreadnought itself was an adapted upgrade of Contemptor dreadnoughts. Essentially, they were scaled up and overpowered. It's rumoured, and given its origin of Terra, that the Emperor was involved directly with its design, and given its advanced status among dreadnoughts, this seems quite plausible. However, because of its size and extremely advanced technology, it's said that the construction of a single Leviathan can be equivalent to an Imperial Knight, and even before the Heresy, this pattern was only available in pretty limited numbers. Dreadnoughts in general, as powerful as they are with their heavy armor, massive firepower, are weakened most by their pilots. Space Marines interred within a dreadnought have often suffered catastrophic injuries, and so are very often little more than a torso and a head, suspended in a fluid sarcophagus meshed with neurosensory fiber bundles that enable them to control the walkers. and this abrupt change in senses and lifestyle can be very difficult even for a space marine. Many have trouble adapting to their newly confined lives, and it's even been reported that among some chapters they will actively resist the possibility of being placed within a dreadnought. If serving as a space marine is seen as a massive sacrifice in terms of the loss of one's humanity, personal relationships, family, and empathy, then becoming a dreadnought is the doubling down of this service to the Emperor. Because marines placed in dreadnoughts will literally only know war from here on. They will fight only in battle after battle, never sharing the wit and the contemplations of regular Astartes. Their only opportunities to converse with others at all may be in the brief periods of repair and maintenance and sentience when their tech marine brothers and mechanicus priests begin briefing and pre-deploying them into an active battle zone. So all of these changes can be extremely taxing, and some marines endure this change better than others. For some, it can lead them into becoming ever more unstable than they might already have been. And sometimes this can be tempered by allowing them to serve within a section of their chapter most befitting their former fighting style, and often their dreadnought will be equipped with weaponry variants that most suit their former lifestyle, thereby helping to reduce the stress on the occupant. Within a Leviathan dreadnought, the sheer power and stresses on both the machinery and the pilot are considerably greater than that of lesser dreadnoughts, and this led to a much higher degree of pilot burnout, burning twice as bright but half as long, you might want to quote. In the aftermath of the heresy, the already rare Leviathans were almost unheard of to be maintained by traitor legions, although it's possible some still exist. The Loyalists, though, had continued access to Terra, and so were able to secure the sliver of new Leviathan dreadnoughts that were able to be produced. Yet those which were created were truly awesome in their power. They towered over other war machines and dreadnoughts on the battlefield. Their size is something that has to be seen to be believed, and their arsenal of weaponry is more than formidable, with in fact most weapon types being used exclusively by the Leviathan. And where the Contemptor dreadnoughts used atomantic shielding, the Leviathans used a more powerful, reinforced atomantic barrier. Both of these shielding types result in a powerful shockwave should one of these massive war machines fall in battle. But the Leviathan is always believed to have been primarily used for siege assaults, hence its massive defensive capability, coupled with its firepower. It sacrifices movement for having to carry such a heavy bulk, although despite this, it's still quite fast considering the mass of it. Leviathans will often be seen to use a siege claw or a drill as a melee tool, being both quite horrific as it is essentially an oversized advanced version of a power claw, and these are seen rarely in Astartes post-heresy. The alternative siege drill is also pretty self-explanatory. It features three large cutting drill bits and can chew through armor, rockcrete quite comfortably, and anything of flesh matter is barely worth of consideration. They'll be chewed and torn to pieces by the huge rotating cutting tools, twisting their enemies apart. And beyond those melee options, Leviathans are usually mounted with three hunter-killer missiles for targeting enemy at extreme range. They can also be fitted with any combination of three arm-mounted weapons, Grav Flux Bombard, the Cyclonic Melter Lance, and the Storm Cannon Array. And although the Leviathan has less options than, say, the Contemptor, that is because the options available are so ridiculously powerful, they just do not need anything else. These can also be fitted as a pair or individually, and they're likely weapons you haven't heard of before because of the fact that they're exclusively used by Leviathan dreadnoughts. The Storm Cannon Array, for example, is a truly insane weapon. Its firepower is essentially comparable to a Primaris Suppressor's Accelerator Autocannon, except instead of one, each array is made of four combined, quadrupling the fire rate of what in the modern era is a fairly slow-firing weapon only used by Primaris, but quite powerful. And to be absolutely clear, the Leviathan Storm Cannon is not the same weapon, it's just in terms of its damage. The Accelerator is the most comparable modern equivalent. It also operates at half the range of the Accelerator. But imagine then if your Leviathan Dreadnought is wielding two of these horrifying storm cannons, and now they're truly living up to their name as they unleash a devastating storm of firepower upon their enemies that can just shred through about anything. Infantry would simply disintegrate in the face of such a weapon. Then you have the Cyclonic Melter Lance, which, just by the look of the thing, you already can conjure some horrifying ideas of just what it's capable of. because this is the epitome of Imperial technology, in the sense that they took an existing powerful thing and then scaled it up. This is why Titans often feature weaponry that exists at an infantry scale, but they just go big, which is always the comical aspect of the Imperium and its technology and its STC standardization. They just keep making the same thing, but slightly bigger every time. So the Cyclonic Melter Lance is, at a basic level, a melter or a multi-melter. But then they said, well, that's good, but what if we multiplied it by 3? Which, as you can imagine, can result in some pretty apocalyptic results. Let me frame it for you this way. If it were able to focus the firepower well enough and dealt critical damage with all of its beams, it could destroy near enough anything on the battlefield. Imperial Knights, an Astraeus tank, Orc war bosses, Demon Princes of Chaos. The firepower of the Cyclonic Melter is truly insane. And that's just for one. Because I would remind again, a Leviathan Dreadnought contains such a powerful generator within its core that you could potentially arm a Leviathan with 2 Cyclonic Melter Lance for a more refined, cultured, face-melting experience. Now you're saying, surely that's enough. Well, hold on, because then we come to the Grav Flux Bombard. Now the word Grav is probably giving away the fact that, like the Cyclonic Melter, this is a scaled-up version of a Grav weapon. You would in fact be absolutely right, because the Imperium is nothing if not predictable. What were you thinking? That they would just invent an original new weapon? That's dangerous thinking, friend. You best stick to your work. If the supervisor hears about it, they'll be sending you off for servitorization. So yes, the Grav Flux Bombard, it's a scaled up version of other Grav weapons used by the Imperium. But saying that really diminishes how horrific such a concept is, because Grav weapons are some of the most truly horrifying tools of war. At the individual infantry level, it's bad enough, but for those used by Mechanicus battle servitors, as I've discussed before, it gets very horrifying very quickly. The Grav Flux sends out a spinning vortex of Grav torsion force, twisting and crushing its enemies under unfathomable forces. And as with all Grav weapons, the nature of them means that armor is effectively useless, and no matter were they to be a humble flak armored human, a Chaos Terminator, even a Primaris, all would be crushed to a pulp in an instant by the focused gravitic beam that would distort and then crush the matter of their bodies in a display of mind-bending horror. Seeing human forms being condensed often together in a bizarre floating sphere of gravitic energy is something few can witness and not break from. But the most interesting thing about Grav weapons is how their power can scale. So unlike many other weapons, when facing a larger target, the Grav Flux will potentially deal a scalable level of damage, which remains the true power of it. Its manipulation of forces make it a truly fear-inducing weapon to overcome, and a massive force multiplier. Because this, in combination with a Leviathan powering it, places it well above most other Grav weapons. Anything that can kill 75% of a 10-man Primaris squad in one hit is not a weapon you really want to be facing on a battlefield. And then on top of all of this, the Leviathan still wields 2 hull-mounted heavy flamers or Volkite calivers, just to round everything out. Similarly, and perhaps more so than all the other ancient dreadnoughts, Leviathans are rare. Wherever they are found now, they will be some of the most cherished and unique venerated chapter relics for the Astartes, perhaps not least because of their connection also to Terra and the Emperor. Undoubtedly, many Astartes who still hold a Leviathan may well believe that it was worked upon by the Emperor himself. And Leviathans are the ultimate war machines. They entirely live up to their name in both scale and power. Some even refer to them as relics of darkness, for they are so rarely seen as to be near mythical, and when one does stride out across the battlefields of the 41st millennium, it can only be authorized by an Astartes chapter master. In part, that's due to their prestige and rarity, but it's also due to the fact that many of the Marines who currently rest within the Leviathan Dreadnought are so racked with both the pain and demand of the machine, something that is only then exacerbated by the memories of the machine itself, for much like knights, Leviathan machine spirits are believed to be so powerful that their machine memories are stained with the blood, the soaked horrors from the Age of Darkness, and this suffering can sometimes override an Astartes within the Dreadnought, leading them to walk off into something of a lucid dream upon a battlefield, in the worst instances perhaps not even able to tell friend from foe, fighting imaginary horrors that are from millennia past. So the unleashing of a Leviathan can be something of a double-edged sword, and certainly not to be undertaken lightly, for the consequences could be potentially far worse than the benefits gained, and so the ultimate responsibility for deploying a Leviathan must always remain with the chapter master. The Castor Ferrum is the dreadnought you will recognise the most, as this is commonly seen throughout the Imperium in M41. It is the very well-known boxy tank, and while it has several slightly different versions of its pattern, these are equivalent to the Mark advancements of Space Marine armour, so for those known as Venerable Dreadnoughts, they are still essentially the Castor Ferrum pattern, but just a little different. And that pattern is also known to be less reliable than modern Castor Ferrum dreadnoughts, likely due to their extended age, and so for Space Marine chapters they require significant maintenance and resources. Whereas the Castor Ferrum is one of the more reliable Imperial dreadnoughts, and supposedly first introduced for its ability to carry out a pretty wide range of tactical roles, including direct assaults, boarding, tunnel, even subterranean combat, and this may account for why it is so plain, smaller, less elegant than the Contemptor, and less of a massive powerhouse versus a Leviathan. They were attempting to solve the problem of, we still want the flexibility and power of the Contemptor, but we can't do it in such a refined way. So the Castor Ferrum Dreadnought is, for the most part, the pretty standard fare when it comes to dreadnoughts in M41. The only difference in them tends to be the variants used by certain chapters. And I won't rattle through every armament for this pattern of dreadnought, because they're pretty standard fare. But the only difference with the Castor Ferrum is that unlike the more advanced and relic dreadnoughts, it's pretty rare to see them with any specialised weaponry. Volkite weapons fell out of use as they required more maintenance and upkeep, and they presumably do not have enough power to enable shielding or long-range ordnance mounted on the carapace. They can of course be mounted with a missile launcher, but this comes at the expense of melee options, limiting them as a ranged unit. However, there are some chapter and faction-specific variants of Castor Ferrum Dreadnought which are worthy to mention. Firstly, the Furioso Dreadnought. Although it is used by some others, it is most commonly attributed to being used by the Blood Angels and their successor chapters. The Furioso Dreadnought replaces the single long-range weapon carried by standard dreadnoughts with a second close combat weapon. But true Furioso Dreadnoughts use special weapons known as Blood Fists and Blood Talons. These are designed by the Blood Angels and can also be given to specialised upgrades used only by the Blood Angels and successor chapters, known as the Magna Grapple and the Frag Cannon. These are weapons that make the melee-focused Dreadnought more effective at medium-range combat. But there is also a sub-variant of the Blood Angels Furioso used by the Death Company. Now hopefully you know the history of the curse that plagues the Blood Angels, because I'm not going to get into it today. But suffice to say, Blood Angels Dreadnoughts are not immune to the effects of the Black Rage. Consequently, if a Blood Angel's dreadnought becomes consumed by this genetic defect, it can be near to impossible for the chapter to restrain or control them. Once chapter tech marines find some option to disable them, then the chapter priests could judge whether or not the dreadnought's Astartes occupant should be sedated until the next battle or relieved of their lives so that another can take the place. If the occupant of the dreadnought is still sane enough to follow direction, he'll be moved to the chapter's death company, where his dreadnought body will be able to withstand tremendous amounts of punishment and his unending rage result in the deaths of swaths of enemy. There are also the variants known as Librarian Dreadnoughts, and these contain the fallen Astartes psychers of a chapter. This is a very rare occurrence because when this happens, a dreadnought of specifically custom design is required, and those are extremely difficult to come by. For a Librarian Dreadnought must enable the further psychic function of the Brother Within, and that means they must be outfitted with built-in psychic hoods, equipped with force weapons, those are melee weapons designed to channel psychic power of an individual, and these can be terrifyingly powerful against entities even who are not connected to the warp. But these Librarian Dreadnoughts are monstrous to face in battle. They remain capable of unleashing their powerful psychic abilities plus the physical power of a dreadnought. In some respects, one might make the comparison to Psi Titans, one of the most terrifying human creations to be deployed to the battlefield, and who unleash such levels of psychic power, it is said even Primarchs retreat from battle in the face of such an onslaught. Librarian Dreadnoughts, of course, are not on that level, but they are still terrifying to behold, as most Astartes librarians are considerably powerful, but they are also very few in number, which means the conditions that would arise to create the circumstances for a librarian dreadnought are extremely rare. They're most commonly seen again among the Blood Angels and their successors, and whilst they might be seen in other chapters, that is even rarer. The Chaplain Venerable Dreadnought is at face value similar to other Venerable Dreadnoughts. They're very prized, they're highly revered by their chapters and so on, and of course what sets them apart is that their occupants are Astartes Chaplains. These are specialist officers who serve as spiritual leaders for the Space Marines in the millennia that have passed since the Emperor took his place on the Golden Throne. And chaplains focus upon the morale and the beliefs of their battle brothers, generally promoting veneration of the Emperor. But of course, not all chapters of Astartes truly accept the spiritual belief in the worship of the Emperor as a god, in fact many do not. But even those will maintain chaplains still, and this is largely for the purposes of appearances, to maintain good relations with other departments of the Imperium and not face investigations, and also to be able to fight alongside and engage with the other chapters who do believe in the Emperor as the god of all mankind. Broadly speaking, chaplains though focus on unity and use their wisdom and spiritual teachings to shape new generations of Space Marines for their chapter. So, it's not all lip service, there is a function for them. So when a chaplain falls in battle, they may be placed in a dreadnought, and this can then offer unparalleled morale benefits to the battle brothers, because a chaplain dreadnought will very often become a living shrine, and a means by which to fuel their righteous hatred for the enemies of mankind. On the battlefield, the dreadnoughts themselves will use their vox and speaker systems to deliver booming oratory proclamations that inspire their fellow Space Marines and humans around them, and will terrify the heretics and Xenos alike. As with all the entombed Astartes, chaplain dreadnoughts possess vast knowledge and insight into warfare, but it is their faith in the Emperor that makes them almost impervious to damage, and they are often seen to fight on in almost impossible circumstances. They can often only be stopped by their complete destruction and that of their sarcophagus. And then there is the Doomglaive Dreadnought. This is one of the rarest and most advanced dreadnought variants in Imperial service, so much so you have likely never heard of it, and that is likely also by design, for the Doomglaive is used exclusively by the Grey Knights. Just as do all Grey Knight Astartes, their dreadnoughts make use of the Aegis, a complex network of protective prayers, runes and other wards which are inscribed upon them, or in the case of a dreadnought, upon the body of its armour. These are psychically charged to provide better protection from the sorcerous powers of demons and the other servants of chaos and the warp. And while a Doomglaive Dreadnought is a fearsome opponent for any to face on the battlefield, the manner in which Grey Knights tend to deploy and be engaged means that it will obviously provide more than just fire support. A Doomglaive is also able to support them with enhanced psychic defences, and this is only made possible as a result of circuitry incorporated into the Dreadnought's sarcophagus, which can link its own Aegis field to the psychic defences deployed by nearby Grey Knights, thus creating a series of reinforced psychic wards considerably stronger than what individual Grey Knights can project on their own. And to visualise this, you might want to think of it in the same way that Titans are able to come into proximity with one another and then merge their void shields, thus creating a greater and more stable barrier. Well, the same occurs with Grey Knights, which could result in a scene of truly epic proportions, with a Grey Knight Dreadnought standing at the centre of multiple squads of brothers, all projecting their psychic shield as a vast deluge of warp monstrosities bears down upon them. Venerable Dreadnoughts are sometimes referred to also as the Ancients, because they will often contain those like the legendary space wolf Bjorn the Fell-Handed or Guldor of the Salamanders. These veteran marines will remember many thousands of years of combat experience. However, due to their often older pattern of dreadnought, they would likely have been interred after the Heresy, but before modern, more stable dreadnoughts were created. This means that their dreadnoughts often feature unstable and less combat effective weaponry comparative to the contemporary time. And these older dreadnoughts can also be more difficult, more dangerous to bring around from stasis given the significant time passed since their previous revival. Of course, they can still be powerful tools of war. Some may even have advanced technology within them, comparatively. But it's just the reality that older pattern units are simply known to encounter more problems. They have more issues in terms of replacement parts, the knowledge of how to maintain them. They may simply need a component which no longer exists. Thus, either because of the difficulty to rouse them from their sleep or the grave concern that they may be unable to function, fight, or suffer some other problematic situation, many venerable dreadnoughts are kept in place, approached by their brothers only as advisors in the governance or planning of chapter operations, or simply a shrine to the past. One of the best examples is, of course, always Bjorn the Fell-Handed of the Space Wolves, and that is because he was once a member of his Primarch Leman Russ's personal retinue and actually fought in the devastating War of the Heresy. Consequently, their knowledge and perspective is beyond estimation for their chapters in the current age. They have seen and will know things that no other can. Their insight is immensely valued by their chapter brothers. In the case of Bjorn, he will be reverently awoken once every century to share his knowledge, the tales of Leman Russ, with the chapter, keeping their ancient traditions alive, and his presence commands the respect of all, from the great wolf to the youngest Bloodclaw. For those venerable dreadnoughts that do maintain functionality, their pilots will remain formidable space marines, and the experience they carry makes them incredibly resilient, lethal, and often far harder to destroy than newly interred dreadnought pilots, even those of the Redemptors. At the same time, this accumulated wisdom has to be balanced against their weaponry, which, whilst potent still, is often far more volatile, and this aligns with the general difficulty in maintaining a venerable dreadnought. For the Tech Marines and Mechanicus assigned to this duty, it is a truly monumental task, not least due to the fact that the scarcity of components makes any repair a significant challenge. A master of the Forge must dedicate a considerable portion of resources to the care of these ancients, and they're always wary of the day when they may not wake again. But despite the challenges, no chapter would dare grant the Emperor's peace to these revered machines. Venerable dreadnoughts are living repositories of a chapter's history and traditions. Their memories preserve what ancient tomes and records cannot. Some are no longer the clean, tightly oiled machines of war they once were, to be sure. Many are cumbersome, aging relics that slowly approach a time when they may never move again, living relics to the chapter's past. But others still stand tall, like the statues of old, poised to unleash their wrath upon the enemies of the Imperium, something that is undoubtedly attributable to the mental fortitude of the pilot within. The Redemptor Dreadnought is a new pattern that has become a terrifying vanguard unit of the Primaris Space Marines. With the advent of the Primaris, crafted by the contentious Mechanicus Master Balisarius Call, the Redemptor Dreadnought is designed for use and to complement the deployment of Primaris Space Marines. Like the Castra Ferrum, it offers mortally wounded marines a chance to continue service to the Emperor. Except the Redemptor is considerably larger and more powerful, comparable even to a Leviathan. And this starts in the heart of the machine, the power core, enabling it to move at the slow, thudding stomp of the older generations of Dreadnought, but it can also move up to a thunderous, ground-shaking pace, almost charging like a Contemptor, running straight through into enemy fire, smashing itself into enemy vehicles and entrenched enemy lines. And where Castra Ferrum dreadnoughts were once left as mainly support units, Redemptors are now more reminiscent of the halcyon days of the Crusade, where Contemptor dreadnoughts charged forth at the front of an Astartes assault. Redemptors carry a loadout that also befits their awe-inspiring scale, and is equipped with either a heavy onslaught Gatling cannon to tear through hordes of enemy, or can wield the newest iteration of plasma weapons seen in the Imperium, the Macro Plasma Incinerator. This also is utilised by other Primaris heavy vehicles and can melt clean through enemy armour or bring down the most abominable Xenos creatures. Interestingly, its close combat weapon still remains that of the ancient Dreadnoughts, a Power Fist, albeit one of the most advanced versions of this weapon and that can tear apart monstrous Xenos and Demon engines alike. The Redemptors, of course, as noted, also carry some carapace weaponry, the Icarus rocket pod or the twin Icarus iron hail heavy stubber. Much of the advantages seen in the Redemptor, though, are not just the firepower it brings, which are modern and more powerful versions of standard Imperial weapons, but really what Kall brought to the Astartes in the Redemptor was a total overhaul of the sarcophagus and its neural link technology. Within the Redemptor, these are said to be now so advanced that its pilot, entombed within its chest, can control the machine with a comparable dexterity and speed to that of a living marine. However, as is often the case with the creations of Kall, these systems are a very fine balancing act. For while he managed to unlock the full potential of Dreadnought war machines, he also increased the intense strain upon the occupant. And this has seen a considerable increase in burnout with Primaris pilots, necessitating the replacement of the sarcophagus more frequently. Now certainly some Astartes who have endured millennia's worth of internment in a Dreadnought might argue this is not necessarily a bad thing. I'll return to that thought momentarily. But there are also two other variants of the Redemptor Dreadnought than the standard, the Brutalis and Ballistus. The Brutalis is melee-focused, designed for maximum shock and carnage. This is the version of the Redemptor that sees the highest burnout among pilots, because the strain of operating such a powerful machine in close combat, with the freedom of movement they're capable of, simply overwhelms the neural pathways of the occupant, because they fight like an unleashed member of the Blood Angels who has succumbed to the Black Rage. But the severe exertion required leaves the occupant fading away into an inoperative state. Its Brutalis talons can surely rip through enemy tanks, infantry, and even knights, which are many times its own size. It can also be fitted with Brutalis fists, which feature wrist-mounted twin-linked bolt rifles to deliver additional anti-infantry firepower. And then they're still able to be mounted with carapace heavy bolters or multi-melters, offering further versatility against any enemy. Then you have the Ballistus Dreadnought, which is pretty self-explanatory. It's basically the ranged variant, as we see with other Dreadnoughts. There's little to say other than it comes with a Ballistus missile launcher capable of firing standard Astartes missiles, and that's paired with a twin-linked las cannon. A Ballistus configuration will generally be used when combating Xenos like Tyranids and Orc to deploy the bulk of its missile weapons against hordes, then saving the las cannon to take down high-value targets like Tyranid Synapse Forms or Orc Stompers. However, there is a significant aspect when it comes to Redemptor Dreadnoughts that may yet be proven a significant disadvantage. On the face of it, Kall appears to have created Dreadnoughts that are comparably powerful to Leviathans in terms of their size and what they can wield, yet much faster. And while its construction and variants represent the greatest advancement in the Imperium's war machine since the Heresy, Belisarius Kall, having masterfully blended his own discoveries in advanced human technology with the newfound might of the Primaris, that one problematic aspect is the burnout seen among the pilots, because this means that the Dreadnoughts remain effectively a pretty standard heavy tool to deploy against the enemies of humanity, which is still, of course, useful to be sure. But what Redemptor Dreadnoughts fail to do is effectively preserve, as well as some of the older forms, the pilot of the Dreadnought, which was entirely the purpose of Dreadnoughts in the first place, because the Imperium has access to many different heavy weapon platforms. Now for sure, some of the Primaris Dreadnoughts have survived longer than their other brothers that they entered into service alongside, but few of their number appear capable of enduring millennia's worth of service to the Emperor due to the burnout required by their systems. So one has to wonder, if this is not a severe oversight on the part of Belisarius Kall, is he not missing the entire point of Dreadnoughts? And that leads me to the final thought for today. Dreadnoughts remain utterly terrifying figures of power on any battlefield, no matter their slow shifting evolution through 10,000 years of grinding technological stagnation. When the Astartes deploy, the most veteran among them, they land as thunderous strikes across the battlefield. Incoming enemy fire deflects and breaks upon their heavily armoured adamantium ceramite carapace, and as they step forward with a slow, ferocious tenacity, the marine within will assess their enemy, pitting their vast wealth of accumulated tactical and combat experience against the foe and the objective in hand. Dreadnoughts may appear cumbersome, slow, not well suited to the fast-moving strikes deployed by many enemies of humanity, But a dreadnought is far more than a heavy weapons platform. They are supremely experienced warriors, never to be underestimated. These constructs are in fact well noted as being difficult to slay by enemies of the Imperium, and as such they present a highly problematic focus point for many Xenos. Ignore the dreadnought and suffer the consequences, but focus upon it and you risk opening up weaknesses in your tactical deployment or your available firepower. And this is one of the key supporting roles of a dreadnought. It exists as an irresistible force that cannot be ignored, yet will prove difficult to bring down cleanly and quickly, and as such is a highly concentrated problem for the enemies of mankind. Dreadnoughts for the Imperium, and especially the Astartes, are more than just tools of war. They hold a significant cultural value and historical importance for a chapter. Dreadnoughts and the Marine within link Astartes to their past. They unify them with the brothers who came before, and as such all dreadnoughts are treated with the utmost respect and reverence. They are powerful machines of war, but in truth, it is perhaps more important the role they play as vital and tangible links to the past. Something that it's important to remember is not always readily available in M41. Their knowledge, wisdom, and insight can be seen by many as even more valuable than their martial skills and the flexibility of heavy weapons that they're capable to wield. Because after all, what Space Marine would turn down the opportunity to fight alongside an ancient veteran brother who may have fought, if not alongside the Emperor, then at least those others who may have shared such a privilege, or even walked alongside their Primarch at one time. Dreadnoughts are machines of war, yes, but they remain holy relics of a chapter, and within, they retain the personal wisdom and presence of mind of some of the most venerated warriors. All are devoted without question to the Emperor and always fulfill their oaths to fight any battle at any time and any place. But they are also the keepers of traditions, the custodians of knowledge, and some may even be sought out to offer advice by brother Marines, even chapter masters. Yet none would pretend to deny the true calling of these Astartes, who endure the intolerable reality they now have no escape from. For when war comes again, they will be called upon to deploy into the most dangerous and severe theatres of war. Awakening a dreadnought to serve his chapter is nothing to be taken lightly, for they are death incarnate. And when a furious dreadnought tears free from its specially customised drop pod to lay waste to the enemies of mankind, some will flee and others tremble at the sight of these ancient heroes bringing glory and vengeance in the name of their chapter, to purge the Xenos and exterminate any and all who stand in open defiance against the God Emperor of all mankind.